Hello. In this audio snippet, we were planning to continue talking about the individual versus the collective, and more specifically in the context of federalism. But for some reason, I kept getting the sense that there was something else we needed to talk about, and I couldn't quite figure out what that was. It turns out that today, or shortly before this recording, the day before this recording, I found out that a certain person had passed away. And when I realized that, I was impacted by that person's passing, and I knew it was significant, and the more I looked into it, I realized that that was probably going to be the main thing we had to talk about today. And you will find the things we'll talk about a bit strange, but I can assure you that it's all related to all the topics we've been talking about, including the death of America that's coming in. Less than 4 months, and Black America in general. Before we go into that person's death and talk about him, and the people kind of related to him, I just wanted to quickly mention something. I don't remember, sorry, exactly when I saw this story. It might have been this past, this week or the week before. I don't quite remember, but it was a story written by a reporter who had gone down to the border here in the US to see how things were going there. As you may know, as we've shared in the previous audio clip, the Title 42 rule has ended, and now we've had this flood of illegal immigrants taking advantage of that Title 42 thing ending. And just as a side note, despite that Title 42, I read somewhere recently that in the 2.5 years that the son of a bitch Bite Me has been shuffling his feet and filling up his nappies in the White House, the U.S. has had an influx of 5 million illegal aliens in those 2.5 years that the son of a bitch has been there. So 5 million. Imagine that. A country receiving 5 million people. And the thing is, the problem is not only the number of people coming in into an economy that has gone into recession, but on top of that, the type of people who are coming in, it is the problem with the culture. These people come with a third world culture with no appreciation for this country. They don't love this country. They are not like the immigrants of old. A few of them might. There are exceptions. There are always exceptions. But I'm talking about the general pattern. The overwhelming general pattern is one of rape. That's how they come with this attitude of, like, the woman is available. Let's go rape her. That's how they see America. They don't see America as this beautiful lady that is to be honored and respected, and upheld, and they don't see it as a privilege to be in America. They see it as an opportunity to make money, take advantage of her, and eventually go back to their countries. They don't have a resentment, or how shall we say it? They don't have a bitterness against what has gone wrong in their countries. They don't care. They don't see themselves as the problem. They don't see their culture as the problem leading to all the poverty, corruption that is so prevalent in their countries. They always see it as happenstance, as if, oh, it just happened, you know. Poverty and corruption and hopelessness, all of this just happened. And it was, they don't realize that it's the product of their own behavior, their own cultural values. They keep taking advantage of each other, raping each other constantly. And you might think, oh, that's just the people in power, the elites who are taking advantage of the poor people. No, no. If you knew these people, if you became familiar with their culture and got immersed in them, in their atmosphere, then you would realize, no, it's a thing that goes like from the lowest of the people to the highest of the elites. In fact, I would dare say that in many cases in Latin America, the people who are at the higher positions, it's still not a majority, but there is a sizable group of people in the quote elite, the people who are wealthy and so forth and prosperous, who are decent people, and their decency is part of why they are rich and successful and so forth, and they have a higher ethical standard than the other people, but the other people tend to resent them for their success, and they see them as oppressors, blah blah blah. So it's kind of ironic that the more prosperous people, the people who are blamed for being the reasons for the poverty and the crime, are actually the people who have a higher standard, moral standard, and who are basically keeping those countries afloat through their good actions. They add enough to value to those societies to keep them functioning and progressing, if that's the word, I mean, for lack of a better word, because they're not progressing towards anything, but at least they're not, you know, going into total chaos, even though a lot of those countries already are going into total chaos. But and that doesn't mean that all the rich people in Latin America are decent people. No, they are. A lot of them are very, very evil and corrupt, and many of them are the very people who rose from poverty somehow through in wrong means or whatever. Who once they get into a position of power, they take advantage of that power to rape their fellow Hispanics. So these people, the culture is one. It's the one that creates the atmosphere, so as we were saying in the previous audio snippet. You change the atmosphere, you change everything. And the atmosphere is created by invisible factors that you sow. It's like you sow all these invisible factors, even when people are not watching, these little things that are being sown into the ground, and then they create an environment, an atmosphere. And the atmosphere is one of corruption and poverty, and cannibalism, taking advantage of each other constantly. And that's why they're poor, they're oppressed, and they are cheaters by nature. Academically, economically, politically, they are cheaters by nature. They like to take advantage of an opportunity to win something without having earned it. So they have this culture, and they come flooding into this country, seeing the opportunity to make some money, but they don't value the society, and they come with bitterness and resentment. They hate America. A lot of them say, oh, America's evil, blah, 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 and you wonder what the hell are they doing here if this country is so evil. But in their world, once you're corrupted morally, internally, then you start believing a lot of inconsistent things. Like you start saying stupid things and you go, wow, this is completely contradictory. You just contradicted yourself. But the moment your mind goes warped, it is warped by unethical values that you uphold, then your logic completely deteriorates. That's why you see liberals when they talk and they get outraged and they go really crazy. You see it in their behaviors because they have no ethics, no moral standard. It's all gone. So when you reach that point, then you start being very illogical and very crazy, irrational. The thing is that these people are coming with a terrible value system, and that's why they are so destructive. It's not racism. It's not, oh, they are inferior people. No, they are inferior people, but they're inferior people because of the values of the cultural values that they uphold, because of the moral decisions that they make constantly in their lives. And they choose to be like that. They make themselves inferior, and they are bringing that inferiority, and they are part of the destruction of this country. These 5 million people have come in 2.5 years. Just imagine that number, 5 million people. And that's just an estimate. I mean, it could be even more. And that's with this so-called Title 42 in place. So now that it's not in place, can you imagine what the numbers are going to be in as the years go on? And so we're having this influx of people, and that's part of it. You know, it's like the condemnation of this country involves this flooding to destroy it, to wipe it off the face of the earth, and that's what's happening. But in the midst of that, the governor of Texas, Abbott, I forget his name, his first name for some reason. I'm not sure if it's Glenn Abbott or Greg Abbott or something Abbott. But the thing is that this Abbott fellow said, we're going to try to stem the tide a little bit because he's the most affected state. He's the, if I'm not mistaken, the state of Texas is the state with the largest border with Mexico. So he sent in, if I'm not mistaken, some Texas National Guards or whatever to the border. And the reporter whose story I was reading was there to watch the whole thing. And he said that it's like this flood of people were coming up this little kind of slope or whatever, I think coming out from the river or something, but trying to get into an open area in the border. And the guards would then come and block them off and kind of show their weapons and everything as if to say, hey, if you cross the border, we will shoot. So then they would kind of see that, the guards, the National Guards, kind of a fitting name in that case, because they were guarding the nation. They would see the National Guards and then try to kind of like back up and try to go in somewhere else. And the National Guards would then follow the people, as they were trying to enter in some other area. And then, the people would then come up and see them again and then back up and go look for another, it's like a rat trying to find a hole to go in through and finding a cat kind of waiting at every hole that they were trying to use. And the reporter, as he was watching all of this, was kind of like amazed at how, how this literal cat and mouse game was going on, and how the guards were effective in, at least on that particular day at that location, at blocking off the entry of these people. And apparently Abbott has been doing this in several parts, and that has helped a bit, but still they're coming in. But as I was reading all of that, I said to myself, well, why are we why haven't we been doing this from the beginning? I mean, why are we waiting until this thing is just going over the top to start doing something like this? And the reason is federalism, because federalism creates this thing where the states have their stupid sovereignty and do whatever the hell they want to their own citizens. And the federal government is supposed to just take care of certain other things, like a list of enumerated powers that they can work on. And one of those is the security of the nation. So it's as if you create these boundaries of jurisdiction where, I can't touch this because it's not my problem. That's a federal thing. You know, that's how the states behave. And so it's like this mindset is put into our thinking as Americans, that certain things can only be done by the federal government and certain things are left to the states. But immigration is not one of them. So so states are kind of always looking to the federal government, waiting for the federal government to do something about it. Because we have this dichotomy, this kind of schizophrenia of federal government versus state government, when it should all be one law. As you constantly see, maybe if you watch American detective shows, they always have, you know, like an episode where they have to talk to an illegal alien who is a witness to a crime, and they always come and try to locate them, and the illegal tries to run away, and they always say, no, we're not immigration, we just want to get your information, get information from you about this crime or whatever, because we're not immigration, that's not our problem. So it's always, the local police saying, hey, federal law is something else, not related to us. We're just here to solve this crime that is within our jurisdiction. And that shouldn't be like that. Law is law. If there's a law, I mean, as we've tried to explain before, the immigration laws of this country are very stupid and very ill-conceived. But regardless, the law is the law. And if someone is here illegally, it is the law of the land. It's not a federal law versus a state law. It's just the law. And we have created just such a dichotomy where people are comfortable, like, distancing themselves. Like, oh, that's not my problem. That's somebody else's jurisdiction. When it should never be like that. Government should be the same across all levels. So the thing is that is what has caused that problem. And then it makes me think that what Abbott was doing was, seems to be working, at least in some areas, because you can only do so much. And I said to myself, when Trump was in the White House, why couldn't he have done something like this? He could have coordinated with the states. You know, down in the South, I mean, most of them are Republican red states. Texas is kind of red. It's been kind of going a little bit purple in some areas, and it's kind of worrisome. And I think, I don't know, I wouldn't be surprised if one day Texas turned purple. And, once the country dies, it really doesn't matter who's purple, who's red, who's white, who's yellow or brown or whatever. It doesn't matter because the country will be dead. It's just... if the whole body is dead, who cares what organ is failing, you know? The thing is that Texas is relatively red, so he would have support from the state government there. He would have support from other states. Maybe in Arizona there is enough red influence or Republican influence to have been able to cooperate, work with the people there. Texas being the biggest problem state, because of their large border with Mexico, he could have worked with them and used the National Guards. He didn't, he didn't have to build the wall to protect the border. If he really had wanted to, if he had really thought of ideas, and maybe someone would have complained, oh, but you can't have the state government involved in immigration. Well, let's deal with that in the courts, or who the hell cares? In the meantime, it's The state is protecting itself from an invasion, and the country is protecting itself from the invasion. So the federal and the state governments working together to protect the border would have been a totally understandable thing. And I would have said, let the chips fall where they may, if they're going to challenge this in court, the stupid Democrats will let them do it. But in the meantime, let's protect the border. It's like, if people are breaking into your house and they're coming in to steal and rape your family members, you don't go, well, I don't know if I should attack them, because if I attack them, maybe I'm going to be the one who's prosecuted for having assaulted this robber. You don't think about that. I mean, you deal with the robbers as you can, and you worry about the legal consequences later. They're invading your house. So the thing that shows me, the fact that they were that Texas was able to begin some sort of effective effort against the invasion, and I know it's partial. This reporter was just seeing one small, sliver of the border. I mean, who knows what was happening elsewhere? But at least that shows that if you're willing to do it, you can do it within the current means. That doesn't mean you didn't have to build a wall. And that also made me think, if this place was such a hotspot of illegal entry, why wasn't a wall there? Why wasn't Trump's wall in that part? You see what I'm saying? And that's what I always said. You have to attack the greatest points of problem. For example, like I am a software developer, and in software development, you sometimes let's say have a software that's running very slow. Slowly, it has speed issues, and sometimes it turns out that when you're troubleshooting what is causing the latency, you end up finding out that the problem is in a small portion of the code. Like, let's say, just to give a number, let's say that 95% of the code is fine, but there's a 5% of the code where the delay is happening. So what you do is you focus on that 5%. Even though it's just 5%, maybe that's 80% of the latency. So you focus on that 5% to get it to reduce the latency as much as possible. Even if you don't touch the other 95%, because you need to focus on that part. But a lot of people, might mistakenly think I have to work on the other 95%, and they start optimizing the other 95% and spend all that time on that 95% to produce a minimal speed improvement when they should have been focusing on that 5%. And that's what I believe Trump did. He focused on the 95%. He put up wall because he wanted to meet a number. Once he finally started building the wall, he wanted to reach a certain number of miles. I don't know if he really reached what he promised he would reach. He promised a number at the beginning. He never made it there, I believe. Then he lowered that number, and I don't know if he made it to that lower number. But the thing is, he was just building randomly instead of focusing on the trouble spots, on the most difficult places where the most entries are coming in. He didn't do that, and that was another problem. But he could have found ways to fix the problem. And also the wall, the way it was built, it was very stupidly done. I would dare say this concept of the wall with the holes in between, the gaps in between where, drug dealers could just, stick their hand through these gaps in between the columns and pass out drugs. I don't know why they did it like that. I don't know who was the moron who decided that was the way to do it. Regardless, that's ancient history, even though it's still affecting us, but ancient history in the sense that we've talked about that, and it's like going over something not worth going over again. But I did want to mention that what happened with Abbott and the National Guards in this incident in the border shows that we had a way to deal with it, but it was hampered by this federalism that has been constantly intruding on our actions, on our thinking. It's like it forces us to think in a different way. And that paradigm just keeps blocking practical, real solutions. And on top of that, it shows Trump's unwillingness to really do something effectively. And he may have wanted to do more, but he always had Ivanka and the son of a bitch Jared, the whore Ivanka and the son of a bitch Jared in his ears, constantly saying things to him, giving him advice that always led him away from finding the true solutions and listening to the truth. He was listening to those two whores more than he was listening to the truth, and that's why he's not in the White House anymore. And on top of that, you know, he was building the wall in places probably that didn't really need the wall, and leaving other places unguarded, places that desperately needed a wall, and the design of the wall is also very questionable. There's so many things that could have been done if they had been done right, but he was not listening to the truth, and that's why he's not in the White House anymore, and doesn't deserve to ever be there again. So that's the one thing I wanted to mention before talking about the person who passed away. A few hours before starting this recording, I found out that, and it took me by surprise. It kind of shocked me. I don't know why. It moved me. I knew the moment I read it, I realized, oh, this is very important. The person who passed away was a man who might not be well known outside of the U.S. His name is Jim Brown. He played football, and by football I mean American football, not the real football, you know, that is called soccer here in America. And American football is my favorite sport. I don't watch it anymore because of the kneelers and all that. And I stopped watching them even before that, even before then it became popular to boycott them for reasons too long to explain here. But the thing is that I was a big American football fan for a long time, and I always knew the name Jim Brown. And to me, I mean, when I started meditating on him after reading that he had passed away, I began to say to myself, well, who is the greatest NFL quarterback of all NFL player of all time? And if you had asked me, I mean, that question at random at any point, I don't know exactly who I would have said. I think I might have said Johnny Unitas, because, you know, I grew up in Baltimore, so I'm biased towards the Baltimore Colts. So I might have said Johnny Unitas just because I grew up in Baltimore. But if I had been like a little bit more objective, I think I might have ended up saying Jim Brown. And for sure, if they had asked me who is the greatest running back of all time, I would have had no doubt. No, I mean, it would have been an immediate answer: Jim Brown, the greatest running back in NFL history, without a doubt. You know, bar none. Nobody has come even close, I would dare say. Well, some have come a little close, but not close enough, I'd say. He is definitely the greatest running back of all time. And Jim Brown, he's almost like the equivalent of Pele in American football running backs. Remarkable player. He was born in February 17th, 1936, I found out today, or a few hours ago. And that to me is very significant, February 17th. If you go to the website where these audio recordings are posted, you may be able to find some things we say about that date. February 17th is very significant. It's the 17th day of the second month. And I hope that kind of triggers a bell in some people. It's a very significant day. The 17th day of the second month. And that is very related to to flooding. Let me put it that way. And it kind of fits into all that we have been talking about now. You know, the country had to go through a flood in a sense, and then be regenerated. But unfortunately, when there's a big flood, there are deaths, but then there's a regeneration. Unfortunately, we will not be part, the country. I say we in a kind of a very symbolic way. We are going to die as a nation collectively. There's not going to be a regeneration. We are part of the people who are going to die in the flood, America. Personally, I exclude myself from that we, because I have distanced myself from America. I'm like divorced from her. But in a sense, I'm still part of it. So I say we in that sense. The 17th of February, 1936, that's when he was born. And he passed away not too many hours from this recording on the 19th of May, 2023. And to me, I knew, you may think I'm exaggerating or making this up, but I woke up on May 19th, yesterday, convinced that this was, because I kept remembering the things we have written on the website where these audio recordings are posted about this date. Every time it comes around, every year, I feel its significance. But this year, I felt it even more deeply than other years. I felt like this is a very, very significant date in American history, the 19th of May, 2023. On the website where these recordings are posted, there is one article where we talk about the 19th of May, 2006. And that would be exactly 17 years ago. And we talked about how significant that date was. It was a date of testing for this country, and we entered into a new stage. No one saw it. It's not like you can go online and read it on the Wikipedia page about, you know, the 19th of May, 19th of May 2006. You're not going to see like a significant event as far as I know. That you might say, oh yeah, that this points to something happening in America. You're not going to see it anywhere, but I know it. I know that when all truth is revealed, I know that people are going to look back and say the 19th of May 2006 was a very significant date in American history. I know it in my being. You may want to believe it, may not want to believe it. That's up to you. But I know that that was a very significant date. It was a date that we crossed a certain milestone of testing, and we entered a certain stage, and we have been failing test after test after test, and that's why we're dying. But it's interesting that he passed away on that date, and 17 years after that. 17 is a very significant number, as we share on the website that where these things are recordings are posted. 17 is a number that represents a manifestation of a greatness, of a great people, of people who emanate greatness and impart it to everybody else. So this man, well, I believe he was very flawed. Don't get me wrong. He was not a saint. this holy saint that with an aura over his head or whatever, but he was a great man. Despite his flaws, he was a great man, a great American. Let me put it that way. He was a great American, and I mean that in the full sense of the word, a great American, a great athlete, and a great American. So he was born in St. Simons, I think that's how you pronounce it, Georgia. I'd never heard of it, of that place, until a few hours ago. But he was born in Georgia, and that's very significant. As we've said over and over again, Georgia was this place that was designated to be the place from which freedom for black people would emanate. The place that would... Georgia, when it was founded, was the way of the truth, saying, hey, this is now when you will end slavery and forgive black people of their transgressions and give them a new opportunity to live in a free environment. Because as we've shared before, slavery was as like a prison sentence on black people. It's like they were dragged from Africa and punished for what they were doing to themselves back in the African continent, and brought, dragged to the Americas and forced to make the sacrifice that they were unwilling to do on their own. Being visionaries, they are. Visionaries are called to make sacrifices for others, and they were unwilling to do it, so they were forced to make those sacrifices, sort of against their will, but for their own good. And they were paying a price and punishment, like a prison sentence. But the prison sentence was ending when the Georgia colony was founded. But America did not understand that collectively. We did not understand that black people had been given over as slaves because they deserved to be enslaved. But then a point came when the punishment was over. It said, okay, now freedom comes. And now is the year of Jubilee, the year of liberation, the year of freedom. And now you are to set them free and treat them like your own brothers and sisters. And America said, no. It's like, oh no, there must be a divine reason why we are their masters. And therefore, we are going to continue like that. And we didn't understand that. But the thing is, Georgia was this place that was created as a place of freedom for people who were in debt. People who owed something and were now being given a second chance to start a new life after paying their debts. That's why Martin Luther King came out of Georgia as well. So this man, Jim Brown, was born in St. Simons, Georgia. But he ended up moving, you know, his family moved to Manhasset. I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce it. I mean, it's nearby, but to be frank, I've really never, I don't know how many times I've heard it pronounced. And I should know this, having been in this area for a while. But Manhasset is in Nassau County, I believe, in Long Island, New York. So it's not that far away. It's in the New York metropolitan area, shall we say. So that's where he grew up. So he grew up in New York. He was born in Georgia and grew up in New York. New York is as America, as New York goes, America goes. That's the fact. Conservatives may not understand that. And when they poo-poo New York, oh, New York is a hellhole, you don't realize you're saying America is a hellhole. If New York goes down and it's going down, then the whole country will go down, and it is going down. And that includes Georgia, that includes South Carolina, that includes Alabama, Mississippi, all the red states, all the redneck states, all of them are going down if New York goes down. But this man was brought to New York, and this is where he grew up. And just before I talk about that, let me just mention something I saw on the Wikipedia article about him. I'm just going to read the paragraph. It says, Mr. Brown credits his self-reliance to having grown up on St. Simons Island, a community off the coast of Georgia, where he was raised by his grandmother and where racism did not affect him directly. At the age of 8, he moved to Manhasset, New York on Long Island, where his mother worked as a domestic. It was at Manhasset High School that he became a football star and athletic legend. So he grew up in this place in Georgia where he was like kind of like not affected by racism, because that's what Georgia was supposed to be. Because Georgia did not really fulfill its calling, it's as if he was allowed to be born off the coast of Georgia in some island off, like Georgia, that island kind of received that impartation that Georgia was supposed to be and had it without so much contamination. And he was born into that environment. So he was, and remember, you change the environment, you change everything. He was born into an environment where he was not trained to think of himself as a victim, as someone oppressed, he said, it's like, I can be whatever I decide to be. He realized that, humanly speaking, he was the architect of his own destiny. And that's one thing most Black Americans don't understand, because the white cracker Democrat keeps telling them that their condition is because of the evil white rich Republican who is oppressing them and being racist against them all the time. So they grew up thinking someone else is the architect of my destiny, and I'm not responsible for my life and the consequences that I live out. So, but he didn't grow up in that environment. He grew up in a different environment, and then he moved north. His family moved north to New York, and his mother worked as a domestic. So he was not, a privileged kid. But he that didn't stop him from believing he could achieve great things, because he knew that he was the architect of his own destiny, as he decided his life would then go in that direction. He was the one who would decide where the ship would go. He was the one at the wheel of the ship, leading it to where it needed to go. And he knew that. He didn't fall for the racism crap that the white cracker Democrat preaches all the time. And, well, he was not born at the time when the Democrats were preaching that nonsense. But even later on, he didn't fall for it as the years went by. And he never saw himself as an inferior human being. He always saw himself as, I can achieve if I set my mind to it. So he was a star in football, basketball, lacrosse, and baseball in high school. And I was reading that he held the Long Island record in basketball, high school basketball, of 38 points per game. I mean, that's how much he averaged. I mean, that's how good he was. He was averaging 38 points per game in basketball. Imagine that. And apparently he held the record for a while until another guy who became very famous, Carl Yastrzemski, and if you follow American baseball, you know who I'm talking about, broke it. He broke that record. So that's amazing to know that he was also this legend baseball player, was also a basketball player. And I had no clue he was from New York, the New York area, because he played for the Boston Red Sox, so he was kind of always the enemy of New York. But he was actually a New Yorker. I did not know that until yesterday, or a few hours ago. But and it's interesting that both, were Jim Brown and Carter Strumsky are kind of mentioned together in this Long Island basketball high school record thing. And just by the way, Carl Yastrzemski is one of these great baseball players who never got to win the World Series. I think he came close in 67, I think. I don't know why I remember him associate him with the year 1967 and the 67 World Series. Not sure why. I think if they were there, they must have played against the St. Louis Cardinals or something. And he didn't win. He was this excellent player, but he never got to experience a championship, which is so sad, because he was a Boston player during the years of the Boston Curse. The Red Sox did not win the World Series for almost 86 years, I think. And he was there during that drought, and I think that's significant too in some way. It's kind of a symbol of America. You know, all the great people with great talent that are here, the people who are listening to the truth, or who would be able to achieve all these things if they were just given a chance. But America's saying, no, we don't want your ideas. We don't want you to succeed, because your success means tearing down a lot of idols that we have in our hearts, and we don't want to tear down the idols. We love the idols more than we love the truth, and because of that, we hate you. We hate you because you're challenging our idols, and therefore America will collectively never win the championship it was supposed to win. despite having great players on its team, sadly. Players that are constantly benched. So the thing is that in his senior year in Syracuse, Jim Brown became a first-team All-American in lacrosse. I mean, that's so amazing. Those of you who don't live in North America might not know what lacrosse is, but it's like a sport that originated with the Amerindians, and it's a sport where you have to carry the ball on the stick that has this basket at the top of on top of the stick, and you pass the ball. You can only carry the ball with that stick, you know, with the basket on that stick, and you pass the ball with the stick. You fling the ball at some other player who catches it with the stick, with the basket on the stick, and so forth. And I think only the goalie. It's like regular football, you know, only that they have a goalie and a goal and so forth. I think only the goalie is allowed to touch the ball with his hands. But the thing is, and I am familiar with lacrosse, familiar enough, at least aware of it. I don't know the rules too well, but I grew up in Baltimore. Baltimore is a big lacrosse city. Maryland is a big lacrosse state. The high school I attended was one of the best in the country in lacrosse. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, they won the national championship or were one of the best in 2008 or something like that, the high school I attended. And the university, I attended two universities in Baltimore. I first went to one, and I'm not going to mention them. You would know that first one by name. It's one of the most well-recognized in the world from Baltimore. I attended, I had the opportunity by scholarship to attend that university for a while, and then I had to transfer to the other one where I eventually graduated. And both happened to be the best lacrosse, had the best lacrosse university teams in Baltimore, and two of the best in the country year after year after year. In fact, they have like this annual game in Baltimore that's called the Battle of Charles Street between the two. And so I grew up in, you know, I went to one of the best high school lacrosse, one of the best high schools in terms of lacrosse in the country, in Baltimore. And I attended two universities that were, where lacrosse was a big thing. So it's interesting to me that this guy that I know is a football star was a lacrosse legend, apparently. It says on the Wikipedia article, I don't know if they're exaggerating, it says he was so dominant. So in his senior year, he was a first-team All-American in lacrosse. He scored 43 goals in 10 games, and he was second in the nation in goals that year. And 43 is very significant because, as we've said before, America's last visible president was Bush 43. We have had no visible president since then. Since then, we've only had an imposter, a naive king, and a senile thief. But there are no more presidents, and there shall never be one again. There might be people holding the title, you know, for a few years afterwards, but there really is no president anymore. The American Republic is dead, and the American Republic ended in 2008, on the 5th of November 2008, having had 43 presidents. So it's interesting that that Jim Brown had 43 goals in his senior year, and he was a first-team All-American in lacrosse. And he was so dominant that lacrosse rules, this is where I don't know if they're exaggerating. It says he was so dominant that lacrosse rules were changed, requiring the stick to be in constant motion when carrying the ball instead of keeping the stick close to the body. And apparently that rule is not there anymore. So I don't know if what happened is that they instituted this rule for a while because of Jim Brown. And then they changed it back. Because I remember, you know, when I watched lacrosse, you know, the players moved the stick around, but I think they would move it more to protect the ball from being kind of knocked off by a defensive player, you know, hitting their stick with their stick. So they are constantly moving the stick, but I don't think it's because of a rule. But it says, according to this Wikipedia article, that because of Jim Brown, they changed the rule apparently for a short while. So we're talking about a big athlete, a very very versatile athlete. So he was a conqueror. You can see that he wherever he decided to invade, he would win. Because it's kind of ironic now that I think about it. You know, this country is allowing a whole bunch of third world trash to conquer this country, invade it, and conquer it. And the people, the true conquerors in the land, the people who are seeking the truth, who are saying all these things that would revolutionize the country and the world, are not allowed to shine and be manifested, which is associated to the number 17, to shine and be manifested and conquer America and the world for the truth. So it's ironic. It's America saying, I'd rather have these prostitutes or these rapists come in and conquer me than have you people conquer me, because that's how much I value my idols. And I'm saying this to conservatives. They are the ones who are the most responsible for this. Even though the Democrats are the ones opening the floodgates and all that, the Democrats would not be there if the conservatives had, especially the Christian conservatives, had not decided to hold on to their idols for dear life, their pastors, their patriotic value system, and their damned constitution and their damned founding fathers and all these things that they and their damned federalism and all this worthless rubbish that they hold on to for dear life. So Jim Brown was a true conqueror. He had that conqueror personality. As you may recall, there are five personalities. There's the judge, the visionary, the conqueror, the server, and the organizer. And he had a lot of conqueror in him. And so the thing is that he went on to play in the NFL, in the National Football League, the American Football League in America here. And he played for the Cleveland Browns. He played for Syracuse at the university level, at Syracuse University in upstate New York. And that's where he had, you know, his success in lacrosse that we were talking about the senior year and all that. And then he went on to play in the NFL for the Cleveland Browns. And he played there from 1957 through 1965, so that would be, I should know this, but that would be what, 78, 59. It's a shame that I'm counting with my fingers. I should know this. Eight. So no, nine. I think it's nine seasons. From 1957 to 1965, and by the way, before he played for the Browns, he obviously played for the Syracuse football team, and his number was the number 44. And I know that and that's very significant, because you know, just like he scored 43 goals, and that talks about, you know, the 43 presidents of the American Republic that died in 2008, his number was 44. It's like he represented what happened after the American Republic died. He represented that, you know, in a sense, he represented the people who could rise to greatness, and after the 43 had passed, being the 44th, if you catch my drift. And his number was retired. But that's the number he had in Syracuse, the number 44. So he went on to play in the Cleveland Browns, and he scored. I mean, he, and this is astounding. If you don't follow American football, you might find this irrelevant, but or mean little to you. But he averaged 104 yards per game. He didn't, you know, when a running back reaches 100 yards in a game, it's seen as a great accomplishment. And it's amazing when, let's say, if you rush for 100 yards in half of the games in the season, you're seen as like having had this astounding season. He didn't score have 104 yards in a few games. He averaged 104 yards. Can you imagine the significance of that? He averaged 104 yards for 9 years. 104 yards per game. That was his average. That was not his maximum or his best output, or just his output in one season. It was over 9 years he averaged 104 yards per game. And he did it with had a career 12,312 yards, which was a record, the NFL record for a long time until I believe Eric Dickerson broke the record, who played for the Rams and the Colts, and then I think eventually Walter Payton broke the record, and I think Walter Payton, sorry, broke the record. Eric Dickerson came close. I don't know if he broke it too. Eventually, I think he did. And then eventually there was some other guy, Emmitt Smith, who broke everybody else's record. But he was never as impressive as Jim Brown. And the reason why I mention these numbers is that I find them very fascinating. 2359 carries. That's 7 times 337. And that's very significant to me for personal reasons that I can't go into. But I just want to mention it out loud. And the other number, 12,312 yards, happens to be, it's a very peculiar number because it's 8 times 9 times 9 times 19. Or said another way, it's like 72 times 9 times 19. And 72 is a very significant number. 72 is associated with like the conquering of the world with the truth. That's what 72 represents. And 9 is number of power. And interesting that then it's multiplied by 19. And 19 is a very bad number. And I've always believed that I've always believed 19 is a bad number, bad number. And to me, it was all confirmed when that number became so associated with the virus that was used as the excuse for the lockdowns and all the nonsense that happened recently. So it's not a coincidence that that's the number associated with that virus. But it's interesting that that number's in there in the factors of his yardage. And I think it's a figure of his achievement having been cut short of reaching the number 20, in a sense. 20 is it's a good number. It's a number of transition into a warring stage, and he got kind of stuck at 19. But I don't think it was his doing or his fault. I hope you'll see it later on if you're still listening. Even his numbers are significant. And he was not only a great running back, he was also a good receiver coming out of the backfield. He actually caught 262 passes for 2,499 yards. And 2,499 is a very peculiar number because it's actually, it's 3 times 7 times 7 times 17. And 17, there's that number again. And 3, you know, and 7, you know, the 7 is a number of a complete spectrum. That's what it represents. That's why the rainbow has 7 colors. So it all seems to kind of portray this Everything about him seemed so fitting. Everything had significance. Even the yardage numbers had a lot of significance. And he led the league in rushing a record 8 times. The National Football League, he led the league in rushing 8 times. And 8 is the number of regeneration. Everything about his career seemed just relevant. He won. Now the thing is that he won the Super Bowl, or well, it was not the Super Bowl at the time. It was the NFL Championship game. He won the NFL title in 1964 with the Cleveland Browns, and they were runners up. They lost the NFL title game in '57, his rookie year, and then in 1965, the year after, they had won this the title. So when he was with the Browns, they were runners up. They went to 3 NFL titles out of those 9 years, and they were runners up in 2 of them, and they won the one in the middle. And interestingly, the 1964 NFL Championship game was played against the Colts, the Baltimore Colts, you know, my beloved Baltimore Colts, who were led by Johnny Unitas and so forth. And they beat them 27 to nothing. And that was the last time the Browns have ever won the NFL championship. They haven't, they have, you know, some people will say, oh, they've come close a few times, but it's close in a very relative, way. But, you know, in all truthfulness, I don't think that it's valid to say they have even come close to really making it. That I haven't even been to a championship game since 1964. They've come close to being in the championship game, but they've never even made it to the championship game, which is now called the Super Bowl, since then. And that's very peculiar, very interesting. The thing is that he retired in 1966. And he retired kind of in a very peculiar situation, and this is all worth mentioning. He was he saw himself as more than just a football player. He said, "I can achieve in all these things," and he didn't care that he was black. It's like, and remember, we're talking about the 50s and 60s, so we're not talking about this era where black people are kind of exalted beyond measure. It's a time of discrimination, of segregation in the South, and where a lot of people were still not willing to see the black man as an equal. And he didn't care. He did not care. And he decided, I'm going to be an actor too. So he got into acting even as he was playing football. And he ended up being in a ton of movies. So he's actually succeeded as an actor. And at that time in 1966, he was in the movie called The Dirty Dozen. And he was in London. This is all very significant, very significant. He was not in the US, he was in London, filming The Dirty Dozen. And The Dirty Dozen, I've never seen that film, but from what I was reading it, it's apparently about this group of prisoners who were kind of taken from prison. They were kind of like, they had death sentences, a lot of them, and they were taken to be part of this elite force that was going to go to France from England. And I think they had to kill, they knew that there was this mansion, I think, or something. I could be misquoting, but I'm trying to give, I hope I'm at least giving the general idea. There was this mansion where these Nazi generals were headquartered, and the plan was for this force, you know, this elite force or whatever, to of people, this group of people, to you know, go into France, reach that house, and kill off all the Nazi generals there, because they wanted to disrupt the the Nazi chain of command prior to the invasion of D-Day. I mean, that's the plot of the film. And Jim Brown was one of the prisoners who was part of this group, you know, in the story. And I think they're called the Dirty Dozen. I think in part because I think they were 12, and I think they were dirty because of an incident where they were punished and not given soap for a while, soap and water, and that's why they were called the Dirty Dozen or something like that. But the thing is that while he was filming that story, and it's significant, you know, that it's a story about the invasion that ended the war, the invasion where America finally crossed the border that it had been unwilling to cross to finally make the commitment to end Nazism, at least in Western Europe. And by the way, as I think we've shared before, Polio Boy, son of a bitch, Polio Boy, who's dead and burning in hell, worthless son of a bitch, he was sympathetic to this, to socialism and to the Soviet way of things. And that's why Churchill kept saying, let's go through Italy, let's invade from Italy and attack the heart of Germany, because he wanted to make sure that the Russians wouldn't, the Soviets wouldn't invade Eastern Europe and use the war as an excuse to take over Eastern Europe. Churchill knew that, and he said, we need to go to the heart of Europe and attack directly, because if we don't, the Soviets are going to take advantage of this. And Polio Boy kept saying, no, 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 no. And yes, there were some actions in Italy, but not enough. There was never a commitment to invade Europe through Italy. And if we had done that, there would have been no Eastern Bloc. There would have been no Berlin Wall. There would have been none of that. But Polio Boy prevented it. So we had to do it through Normandy and D-Day. And it was not supposed to be like that. Yeah, I think that eventually there would have been an invasion, a D-Day invasion from, you know, into Normandy, but it would have been as we were fighting in Italy and into Germany directly, into the heart of Europe. Yes, it would have been bloody, but, you know, it was going to be bloody anyway, but the war would have ended much faster. And who knows, maybe fewer Jews would have died in the Holocaust as well. But, well, the thing is, I'm digressing a bit, but the thing is that he was in this film that had to do with this important invasion to conquer and finally defeat the enemy. And he was in London, not in America, he was in London. But because of bad weather, the filming was getting delayed. And this is where the thing gets interesting. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to get to all the details. And I know this sounds boring, like, why is he talking about all these sporting things, but it's all relevant. If you could see it, I hope you can see it. If you could see it, then you'll understand, as a certain song says. The thing is that Art Modell, he was the owner of the Cleveland Browns at the time. He in fact took over the Browns in 1961. And interestingly enough, Art Modell was born in Brooklyn, New York, to a Jewish family. He was born in Brooklyn, in New York. A New Yorker ended up owning the Browns in 1961. It's all related. Everything is all related. And he actually died in Baltimore. So, interestingly enough. And the thing is that he threatened Jim Brown and said, if you are late because of the filming of this movie, if you're late to our training camp, I'm going to fine you. So be aware. If you're late, I am going to penalize you for being late. And you know, Jim Brown was, he didn't want to be late, but the filming was getting delayed. And instead of Art Modell trying to kind of like work something out with Jim Brown, obviously he had to make sure Jim Brown didn't get preferential treatment or whatever, because that would have looked bad to the rest of the players. But he could have done it in a more diplomatic way and kind of work things out, and also, you know, let the players know, hey, it's not that I want to give preferential treatment to Jim Brown, but we worked this out and whatever. He could have done it in a much better way, but because he was so drastic with it, like, you're going to play football, and what is this thing you're doing with acting when you're supposed to be playing football? That angered Jim Brown, and Jim Brown said, okay, if that's the way you're going to be, that I'm a football player and I'm supposed to be committed to that or be penalized, then okay, then I'm not going to be a football player anymore. So he just quit, just like that, in the prime of his career. And he could have gone on, I would dare say, 4 or 5 more years, and he could have increased that record, career rushing record, way up further. And it actually took a long time for anyone to break his record. He did it in 9 years. And Walter Payton did it in, I think, I could be wrong, I could be making these numbers up, I think he did it in 13 years or whatever, or longer, it might have been less, but he did it in a lot more games than Jim Brown. And Walter Payton was a great football player too, but Jim Brown was at such a high level that if he had been able to play 4 or 5 more years, he could have just made that record and maybe very almost impossible to break. The thing is that he quit, and it's also almost like a figure of, it's as if America, it's a figure of America telling the truth, those who speak the truth, hey, okay, you go do your thing, but if you start messing with my schedule, with my programming, with my plans of how I see America, being run in future, then I'm going to penalize you. And it's as if those who speak the truth go, no. Then I quit. And so he quit after 9 seasons and never made it to the 10th season. And that's a very important transition from 9 to 10, because that's when you go from single digits to double digits. And he wasn't able to make it. And because he didn't want to compromise his principles. You're making me look unethical, like I am, not being professional in my... And he was a very professional player, very professional. He was not a hot dog like a lot of the modern-day black players. He was a dedicated man. He did his job and was very, very professional about it. But... he was being treated as if he was not being professional. He said, okay, then I quit. All right. And then now you can't penalize me or call me unprofessional, because now I'm switching careers. And he dedicated himself to acting full time after that. The thing is that, so he won the, this championship in 64, was a runner-up in 65, and then and then he quit, and he never made it to the 1966 season. And Art Modell continued owning the team. He owned the team from 61 for 35 years, at least in Cleveland, and until 1996, I think. And they never made it to another championship game after Jim Brown left. And that was like a punishment on Art Modell for having done that to Jim Brown. It's as if, call it karma, call it whatever you want, but that's a punishment. There are consequences. And to the point that the Cleveland Browns died, in a sense. And that's a figure of America. America didn't let Jim Brown be Jim Brown, figuratively speaking, and America's going to die because of that. The Cleveland Browns eventually died as a franchise, and they left Cleveland. And interestingly enough, they went to Baltimore to, in a sense, be a replacement for the Baltimore Colts, who left in 1983, which I still remember. I was in, as a kid, and I remember when I heard about the Colts leaving Baltimore, when I heard about that Mayflower van, you know, those Mayflower vans taking everything out of Baltimore and going to Indianapolis. But so he brought football back to Baltimore. And it was such a bitter breakup with Cleveland that he eventually said, okay, Cleveland, you keep the name, the Cleveland Browns, the franchise, the team colors, everything. And eventually the Cleveland Browns were reborn as a new franchise later on. So the Baltimore Ravens are officially not seen as as the Cleveland Browns, you know, like as a new franchise. Like, you know, when a franchise moves, they usually bring their history and their records and everything with them to the new city. But in this case, it was like a complete separation. When the Ravens left, when the Cleveland Browns left for Baltimore and became the Ravens, it's like they became a new, brand new football team. It was even though it was the same players, they went on to play in Baltimore as if they were an expansion franchise. And then eventually the Cleveland City got another football team, and they are still called the Cleveland Browns. They have the same colors, and they are a continuation of the franchise that died in 1996, but they've been a failure since then. They've never really done too much good. I think they're kind of a semi-decent football team now, but who cares now? When it mattered, they weren't that good. They were awful for a lot of years. So that's kind of a figure of that. And Art Modell, and the thing is, when the Cleveland Browns left, the atmosphere of Cleveland, because there's like a curse on Cleveland. There's always been this curse on Cleveland. Cleveland has not had a championship since 64. Oh, until recently, officially, they won the NBA championship with this jerk, this worthless piece of dirt called LeBron James. Worthless trash of a human being who will burn in hell the day he dies. He's worthless. He's useless. He's a useless piece of trash. Popular and appreciated by so many people because he's worthless. He is evil, worthless, a selfish bastard, self-serving bastard, evil. The thing is that they did win some title, but it doesn't count. All of those titles don't count anymore. It's all over. The NBA died even way a long time ago, even before the NFL died and Major League Baseball. But but Cleveland has always had this curse. I remember there was something like off, and I knew for some reason the moment. And they had this off these ugly uniforms, and you know, that Cleveland Browns uniform is ugly as sin. I've always hated it, even when I was a kid. I said, why do they wear those ugly uniforms? But when they moved to Baltimore and they changed their uniforms and the team name and everything, it's as if the curse was removed and they were finally able to be free and thrive. And shortly after moving to Baltimore, I think it was like 3 or 4 years, having returned to Baltimore, they won the NFL championship. And I can imagine the Cleveland Browns fans kind of like hating that because, oh my goodness, We supported this team for years and for decades, and they would never win a thing. And they leave us, and 4 years later, in another city, they finally win the Super Bowl championship, the NFL title. And the reason for that is because they left the environment. Remember, you change the environment, you change everything. And they changed to a new environment, and suddenly they thrived. They had a few tough years at the beginning. But then in they won Super Bowl 35. I remember watching that game, and it was interestingly against the New York Giants. They won Super Bowl 35 against the Giants, against New York. And that's when it's as if Art Modell had his redemption. And as a side note, this seems like another digression, but very quickly, you know, this thing about moving to a new environment is very important. It's one of the things that I don't understand why Republicans don't talk about that, conservatives, and they don't talk about it because they don't care about the subject. And they don't care since 1876. And when we get back to 1876, in the election of 1876, you will begin to see why. Ever since then, the Republican Party has not cared. But if they cared, they would talk about this. They would say, you know, the thing about a lot of black young kids, you know, live in despair and poverty and have a low standard of living throughout their lives because they grew up in this horrible ghetto environment of crime. And, you know, these black kids had to live with the smell of cannabis. I mean, way before cannabis became legalized in so many parts of the country. It's like, I suffer with that all the time now here in the New York area, and I can only imagine these kids were living with that even before that, decades ago. So you grew up in this environment that smelled that with the stench of cannabis in the air, with bullets flying at, you know, and you hear the pop, 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 pop outside at night. While you're sleeping, you're an 8-year-old boy, you're listening to the pop, 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 and you hear all these people, you know, using all these cuss words all the time, and you hear about all the gang banging and all the drugs and the heroin and the drug trafficking and all that. And you grow up in that environment, there's very little chance that you will make something of yourself, because it's an environment of hopelessness. And then the white cracker comes and tells them, those idiot white liberal crackers come and tell them, hey, you know why you're in a mess? Because those evil white rich Republicans, see? So vote Democrat. And these black people just idiotically follow the white cracker and don't realize they're becoming slaves to the white cracker again, to the sons of bitches who tell them all these lies and don't allow them to grow into the fullness of their potential. But the thing is, the key is to change the environment. And if the environment is so crooked, what you have to do is teletransport people out of there. You know, get them out of there. The good people, the people who want to make something of themselves, grab them and move them somewhere else. You know, that's why I remember back in the 60s and 70s, there was a lot of debate in America about busing. And I don't know why the liberals, the Democrats hated, if I remember this correctly, they hated busing. And busing had to do with, you know, getting young black kids from tough neighborhoods and busing them to so that they could attend schools in other neighborhoods. And Democrats hated that. I don't know why. I don't understand why Democrats, the white crackers, sons of bitches, Democrats always want to keep black people segregated. Separated, because the reason why they didn't like that is because it kind of like broke their agenda. Because once you have a young black kid growing studying in a different school with a completely different environment, surrounded maybe mostly by white kids, it's like you allow him or her to breathe a new air. And it's like their thinking is allowed to be transformed and changed. You change the environment, everything else changes. And that's what busing was allowing them to do. But the Democrats kept fighting that until eventually, I think that was overturned. And the teacher unions didn't like that, because if the good kids were being bused out, and that means fewer students in those neighborhoods, and that means fewer teachers. And that means, you know, less job opportunities for the incompetent teachers in those public schools. And the other schools, you know, the better schools are more competitive or more selective with their teachers. They're more demanding with their teachers because they have a better standard teaching. In those public schools, it's you know, whatever that, you know, whoever just, you know, is officially fulfills all the technical requirements can be a teacher, and he or she can be a crappy teacher, the worst teacher in the world, but who cares? You know, he or she's teaching in this black neighborhood, who cares about these black kids? You know, so that's how they know that busing was not beneficial to the incompetent teachers in those neighborhoods, so they fought against it. So now, you know, everybody stays in their neighborhood. And that's also why they're against charter schools, because charter schools is kind of a similar concept, only without the word busing in it. And it's also why Democrats also love to have black people living in projects. They build these low-income projects to segregate black people and have the environment of degradation and decay happening there. And then they can use these black people and grab them like idiot slaves and take them to the ballot box and say, hey, vote for against the Republicans because they are the reason why you are trapped in this bad environment. And all these black slaves just go ahead and do it. They're following the white cracker, the white Democrat cracker who tells them what to do. But the key is for the white cracker to put all these people in this environment, and they segregate them and put them all together, and so that they live in this environment of crime and hopelessness. And I'm saying all of this because kind of you can see the change when the Cleveland Browns, the players, the same players, left Cleveland, left that deadness. There was something wrong with Cleveland. There's still something wrong with Cleveland, no matter what Drew Carey might say. But the thing is, when they left Cleveland and moved to Baltimore, the environment changed, and they had fans who had a different mindset. They still had the Colts fans who were, the Baltimore fans were very loyal, very special fans. And they arrived in Baltimore, and it was a completely different environment, new stadium, new uniform, everything changed, and they became a different team, and they won the championship. And then they won again. And interesting, I think I'm going to say this, but time is running out. I really didn't get to everything, but Art Modell died in Baltimore after having moved the team to Baltimore and this is very important, on the 6th of September of 2012. And if you've been paying attention to things recently, that date should ring a bell. The 6th of September, 2012. Because 10 years later, exactly 10 years later, somebody very well known around the world also died. And I don't think I have to say who that was. And so Art Modell died on the 6th. This is all related to the death of America. If you could see it, then you would understand. And I hope you are seeing it. So he died on that day, on the 6th of September, 2012. And the Ravens... that year, that season, the 2012 season, and football seasons start in September in America, and they end, the regular season ends in December, and then they go into the playoffs, and the Super Bowl then is played in either January or February of the next year. So in 2012, the Ravens played and didn't have that great of a season, but somehow when they got to the postseason, I was interceding for them constantly. And they, in that particular year, for a lot of reasons, and they made it to the Super Bowl again, made it to their second Super Bowl, which was Super Bowl 47, and they played against the San Francisco 49ers, who were being quarterbacked by a certain kneeler called Colin Kaepernick. And he was an up-and-coming, I think he was a rookie or second-year player that year. And I liked him when I saw him, but I knew that the Ravens had to win that Super Bowl, but I felt bad. I in my heart, I wish, it had been a different circumstance, and that Colin Kaepernick had been able to win, but sadly he threw it all away afterwards, and then became the head of the kneeling movement. The thing is that the Ravens beat the 49ers 34-31 in that game, and they were way ahead at the beginning. And then there was a blackout in the third quarter, something that never happened. It was in New Orleans, and that is very significant too. New Orleans represents a lot of bad things. And New Orleans, they played the Super Bowl in New Orleans. There was a blackout, and the whole stadium went black, which was kind of an embarrassment. The biggest game of the year. Millions of people watching on television, and the lights went out. And after the lights went out, the 49ers went on a rally and they scored 17 unanswered points, and I was so concerned. I was interceding for the Ravens, you know, very intensely. But the 49ers were making a comeback, and then the 49ers were down by 5 points, and they were about to score a touchdown. They were on the 7 yard line or something. And then they were stopped on the 7 yard line. They were not able to score, and the Ravens took over, and they conceded a safety, and then eventually won 34-31. So it was a very tight game. So and it's kind of very symbolic of America in many ways. We had so much for us. We were so far ahead. We could have just completed the victory, but something evil came. A darkness came over the land, and all that we had gained, we started losing. Now, in this case, the light won, because it was still 2012, and we were not dead as a nation yet. But it was like a bloom, like a sign of where we were heading. And now we're on our way to die, and we will be dead in less than 4 months. I have absolutely no doubt about it. This country will be dead in less than 4 months. There's nothing that's going to happen that will change that. And you know why? Because I don't have faith in this generation. I believe in miracles. I've always said it. I believe in miracles. I've seen them in my own life. And if I told you this, the details that I've seen, I have seen it with my own eyes. I know that miracles can happen. But see, the thing is, I can't put my faith in people in this generation of idiots, of American idiots. It's like trusting a weakling to lift a 300-pound weight. It's not going to happen. You can wish all you want. It's not going to happen. So the country is dead. The Ravens won that day so that we could just continue living and breathing, but we will be dead. And I wanted to get to the original reason why I wanted to talk about Jim Brown, and it has to do with something that he said, in 2018, I guess we'll have to say that in the next audio clip. But before that, I did want to mention that Jim Brown also starred in a film called 100 Rifles, and he starred in it. I think they filmed in Spain, which is interesting. So he had his two biggest films, shall we say, with filming in Europe, not in America, but in Europe. And I hope I'm not misquoting this, but I do believe 100 Rifles was filmed in Spain. It's like this Western type thing. So they had to go to this dry desert environment. So they chose Spain, if I'm not mistaken. And he starred in that film. He was, I think, the star of the film, or the protagonist, I think they call him, call that. And he starred with Raquel Welch, interestingly enough. And Raquel Welch is another interesting story. And I think we will talk a little bit about her and Jim Brown and see how similar they are in some peculiar ways. And Raquel Welch, by the way, died on February 23rd of this year, too. So she died the same year as Jim Brown. And I know it's not a coincidence at all, not even close. So she died 6 days after Jim Brown's last birthday this year. So we'll talk about her and a little bit about her, not too much. And then we will finally get to what I wanted to get to, the interview, an interview that I watched on YouTube in 2018 with Jim Brown and some interesting things he had to say. And they kind of tie in with Raquel Welch's life too, in some ways. And it talks up, and it has to do with Black America. It has to do with America as a whole. And I hope that after we get to that interview and talk a little bit about it, that you will see why we spent so much time talking about Jim Brown and how he relates to Black America, to America in general. And I hope that you have seen how, in those little, weird little details, his life is very much connected to America and kind of a parallel of how America is about to die. Not that he was dying, you know, like America, but in his life or the events associated to his life in some way or another, you can see like a picture of America and why it has to die. It didn't appreciate the Jim Browns, so the Jim Browns have to move on. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll hopefully finish this in the next audio snippet and maybe go back to talking about federalism and collectivism, and then eventually get to 1876, which has been waiting forever. Thank you very much for listening. Mm-hmm.